It's going to hit you in the wallet today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump presses ahead with steel and aluminum tariffs aimed at our closest allies, Europe, Canada, and Mexico. But who will end up paying the added cost? Yep, you and me.
Eventually, consumers will pay all of it. You know, consumers always pay tariffs, is the way that economists will put it.
Plus, we hear how a trade war between the U.S. and China could make your medical care more expensive. And later, residents of the tiny Alaskan island of Attu were taken prisoner by Japan during World War II. Many died in Japanese captivity. 7 decades later, the daughter of one of those prisoners finally makes it back home, and we tag along.
We're here. We made it. We're getting ready to land on Attu.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. The Trump administration has announced more U.S. tariffs. The measures target steel and aluminum from Mexico, Canada, and Europe, and they're expected to go into effect at midnight. And the blowback? It did not take long. Mexico has already responded in kind with tariffs on pork bellies, grapes, and apples. Europe has mentioned taxing American bourbon and motorcycles, and Canada has proposed tariffs on whiskey and orange juice. To get more on this, we turn to Megan Casella. She covers trade for Politico, and I asked her how much the U.S. relies on steel and aluminum from Mexico, Canada, and the EU.
Well, Canada by itself supplies more than half of the aluminum that we import from abroad every year, and the three countries together supply more than half of the steel. So it is a substantial amount. When Trump first announced his steel and aluminum tariffs a couple months ago, but exempted these countries and a couple of others, there was sort of a collective sigh of relief, like, okay, you know, he's targeting steel and aluminum, but he's not targeting our major sources of it. But now that's changed.
And what businesses or manufacturers in the U.S. are likely to be affected by this? And then how could that affect American consumers?
Eventually, consumers will pay all of it. You know, consumers always pay tariffs, is the way that economists will put it. But if you think about it, it sort of affects everyone because, for one, of course, it affects manufacturers and automakers and those who use the materials in their products. But then even a company like Walmart uses steel and aluminum to build the shelving in their stores. So even if they're not selling steel and aluminum product, they're still using the materials.
Mexico, Canada, and the European Union obviously are not happy about this. What reaction have you heard?
They're definitely angry. I mean, the EU was a little bit more expecting this to come because they've had some, you know, not so productive conversations in recent weeks with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and other senior members of the administration, but they're still not happy. And Canada and Mexico were caught even more by surprise because they're in the midst of the ongoing renegotiation of NAFTA, and they sort of hoped and expected for a continued exemption, at least as long as those talks were ongoing. So all three have pledged to retaliate immediately. There's no specific timelines in place yet. They might be delayed by a few days because of World Trade Organization rules. But they're going to do what they can to hurt the U.S. right back.
Mexico, Canada, and the EU were initially exempt from these tariffs, which were really directed at China. So how come that exemption did not get extended?
They had granted the exemption in the hopes that Canada, Mexico, and the EU would come forward and relent on certain points and trade tensions and say, okay, you know, we want to avoid these tariffs, so we'll give you this, that, and the other thing. And the administration didn't really get that the way that they wanted. It seems like Trump wanted a little bit more and wanted more progress to be made. He wanted NAFTA talks to be finished already. And because he wasn't seeing that, he sort of said, okay, well, I'm frustrated and I'm going to go ahead and impose these tariffs.
Mm. So despite the kind of small print on the wall, it sounds like this came as something of a surprise for Mexico, Canada, and the EU. Am I wrong?
No, not at all. I was talking with some Mexican and Canadian negotiators last night who said, we haven't heard anything. We don't know yet, you know, whether we're getting hit with tariffs or not. This was a Mexican negotiator. And then 10 minutes later forwarded a news article that said they were going to get hit with tariffs. So they were getting their news from news reports the same way that everyone else was. They hadn't heard from the White House as of last night.
Now, Donald Trump has said the quantities of steel being imported to the United States are a threat to national security, and that's a big reason for imposing the tariffs. Is that a reason that allies like Mexico, Canada, and the EU can buy into?
Not really, no. Canada keeps saying, frankly absurd, that they would be considered a national security threat given that they're allies in NATO and in defense and in everything else. You know, the root of the problem is China. It's like almost internationally agreed that global overcapacity in both steel and aluminum, that the root cause of that problem is China. And what other people say is rather than impose tariffs on our allies, we should be trying to use a multilateral approach and get allies on our side to work with the United States and try to combat China's overcapacity problem.
How come the U.S. doesn't impose the tariffs just on China?
It would be harder to do that. I mean, the statute that they're using allows for a global tariff rather than just one on China itself. They, of course, want to act tough on China, but they sort of say, well, you know, you guys have a trade surplus over us also. And so this is one way of reducing that.
And Megan, as far as a actual trade war with Mexico, Canada, and or the European Union, are you hearing rumblings of that already? Or do you think those alliances are just too important?
It's tough to say at this point, because part of me says, oh, the history is there. Those alliances are just too important. But, you know, those countries, they all are going to retaliate. They say it's coming immediately. And the question then is where things go from there. We saw with China when they pledged to retaliate that the president was angry and the White House upped its ante and said, OK, then we're going to, you know, impose tariffs on even more goods. So I think the next step is going to be important to watch. If after the EU, Canada and Mexico retaliate, will Trump raise the stakes even further and threaten to impose even more tariffs, or will things sort of level out there? I think that's going to be the most interesting thing to watch.
Megan Casella there. She covers trade for Politico. The U.S. is also picking a trade fight with China right now. And one of the industries here that could be most affected, healthcare. I'm talking about everything from pharmaceuticals to medical devices. Atif Nawaz is a medical device analyst for the healthcare team at Global Data. That's a market intelligence company. And he joins us from Toronto. When we say medical devices, what kind of products are we actually talking about, Atif?
So medical devices encompass commoditized goods that are used in hospitals, healthcare settings, anything from a syringe to more technologically advanced solutions such as an electrocardiograph or an MRI machine. So that's what we mean when we're talking about a medical device.
That seems like it could be a lot of things. How many medical devices could be affected by tariffs on China?
It is a wide range of devices. I would say it would be in the billions of dollars rather than millions. And medical devices are the third largest category within the document that was released by the Office of the United States Trade Representative, which encompasses which devices the tariffs will be levied against. It includes materials such as electromagnets used in MRI machines. And sometimes they're actually referring to a specific medical device, while at other times they're referring to a category that a medical device would fit into. And that's worrisome because multiple product lines can be put under specific categories. Something that says immunological products, that means anything related to immunology, which is a huge segment of the in vitro diagnostics market. And that includes pharmaceuticals as well, including antibiotics. So it ranges from calling specific things out while leaving language vague enough so multiple things can be included in there.
Are these products made almost exclusively in China? Like, can they be produced in the U.S. instead?
The issue that arises here is there are large multinational companies that have multiple distribution and manufacturing plants and infrastructure set up within China, US, Germany, France. So not only Chinese companies will be affected, but US multinational companies will be affected as well. An example of this is Roche. Roche is a huge company within the medtech industry and the pharma industry. They make pharmaceutical drugs and medical devices, and they have a large distribution and manufacturing center in China. So not only will it affect companies that are specifically in China, but it will affect companies like Roche, which are multinational companies that, because of commerce today, are in multiple nations.
So take that a step further. If there is a trade war, what impact would that have on medical technology and the pharmaceutical industry?
So if you levy the 25% tariffs on medical devices and medical device components, then definitely the cost will increase for manufacturers. What these large multinationals are going to do is they're just going to roll the cost down. And at the end of the day, the consumer is affected. This is not beneficial for anyone involved. It hurts the industry, and it would affect, at the end of the day, the average Joe.
Yeah, well, how concerned are you about the effect from a trade war, like a patient in critical need of a stent or a pacemaker? Could that be a problem?
That could be a problem because specifically cardiovascular stents, which are high-end medical consumables, are included in that list. And the cost is going to be rolled down, especially within the U.S. The costs of healthcare are already exorbitant compared to many other nations.
Atif, what reaction are you hearing from both Chinese companies making these products and from companies that need them here in the U.S.?
So companies like Roche that are like multinational and based in the U.S. have not actually rolled out any official stance, but I'm sure internally they are strategizing in how to deal with this and mitigate the effects. the Office of the United States Trade Representative wanted to finalize a list that they want to release by June 15th. China is not happy about this. They've actually responded by trying to recruit some nations within Europe and Asia to start taking action against the U.S. Companies such as Mindray, which is a large medtech company based out of China, they're very worried about this. This can affect multiple product lines that they have, such as patient monitoring devices and some of their pharmaceutical drugs related to diabetes. Publicly, their president is saying, you know, we're hoping that this does not happen. There are new developments. This Saturday, actually, the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is set to be in Beijing. So hopefully we can get some positive news out of that meeting. But this is all, again, very intricate, and it's a multifaceted issue where the consequences will be very worrisome for the medtech industry.
Atif Nawaz there. He's a medical device analyst at Global Data, a marketing intelligence company. The trade tussle between the United States and China, that's maybe just a symptom of something larger.
This is a moment where another form of global leadership is emerging, that of China, with very strong traditions of an authoritarian mindset, of authoritarian practices at home, but also with a desire to see the international community as a whole really butting out of what's happening in other countries, not putting pressure on leaders, even in the face of scandals and tragedies.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. She calls China's efforts to displace the United States as the dominant national security superpower a tragedy.
You know, of course, there's a fine line between, you know, a healthy respect for what goes on in other countries and cultures and communities, but also believing that standing up for human rights and democracy around the world is a good thing. And right now, the United States is vacating the global stage, in effect, leaving it to China and other countries who have a wholly different instinct when it comes to kind of how the world should work and what the rules should be, but handing over that stage. And whether that's on human rights and democracy or whether it's on Iran's, you know, nuclear program, which was shut down by an agreement that the Obama administration did, or whether it's on our warming planet and the need for each country to take relevant and bold steps to curb emissions so that we leave a planet that is habitable to our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids. You know, stepping away from leadership in all those areas doesn't mean that leadership won't come. It will come. It'll just come in a very different form than is compatible, really, I think, with the interests of the United States and the interests of democracy generally. So it's a very unfortunate time, and it's going to prove to be self-defeating, not only to people like me who are critical of President Trump as it is and would have preferred him not to get elected, to say the least, but it's going to prove extremely destructive for the interests of the very people who support his vacating of American leadership. They're the people in the end who are going to be hurt, arguably the most, frankly, from the policies that are being pursued.
Ambassador Power, you come from a world most recently where diplomacy was admired, even revered. And now as a substitute, we've got an American president in a tweet war with a Mexican president or any other number of heads of state, depending on the day. How do you make sense of the moment we're living in now, where diplomatic protocol is even mocked?
What we have is a president here, and you're seeing also leadership like this, if you want to call it leadership, around the world as well, in a lot of quarters, where one audience is more salient and more important than all the others. And so we have a president who is catering to a base that appears, at least for now, I do expect this to change, but sort of like this, to feel like this is America, you know, standing up for itself, feeling as though America has somehow been ripped off by performing the role that it has performed since the Second World War, trying to underwrite the international order, you know, with all the imperfections along the way. Nonetheless, that role of leading, building the United Nations, building the World Bank, the IMF, the other international institutions, based on an idea that a kind of positive sum conception of the world, that's what's good for the world is good for the United States and vice versa. We now have a zero-sum mentality, and that comes with it taunting of other countries, even close allies, throwing contempt on initiatives by one's predecessor rather than trying to behave, I think, with class and respect for the effort that others made, treating civil servants and public servants, again, who aren't in it for the money, with a complete lack of respect. And again, with one core audience in mind.
Former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power. You can hear more of my discussion with her and anti-sex trafficking advocate Sunita Krishnan on the show next week. Just ahead, Native Alaskans return to Attu Island decades after their families were taken prisoner by Japanese troops. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Yesterday, we brought you the story of the Battle of Attu. That's when U.S. forces reclaimed an American island at the tip of Alaska's Aleutian Chain from the Japanese during World War II. This month marks the 75th anniversary of that battle. But there's another part to this story. When Japan invaded in 1942, there were 44 people living on Attu Island, nearly all of them Alaska natives. They were taken to Japan as prisoners of war, and half of them died there. When the survivors returned to the U.S. after the war, the federal government refused to let them return to the island. Last August, Zoe Sobel of member station KUCB accompanied 11 of their descendants as they visited their ancestral home for the first time.
Almost no one visits Attu Island. The only way to get there is by boat. And navigating the governmental red tape that regulates the island is a logistical nightmare. But last summer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made time to ferry Attu descendants from across the Pacific Northwest back to their ancestral home. One of the stops to pick up passengers is in Atka, a town of 60 people in the western Aleutians. After a day on shore, everyone scrambles aboard the research vessel Tekla, and they're off. On the ship, the main hangout is the galley.
Crystal Dushkin from Atka and descendant of Attu as well. It was something, I think, like a lot of us, something I never ever expected to happen in my lifetime, to make it all the way there.
Dushkin grew up steeped in Unangan culture. She's eager to see the old village site where her great-grandmother Mary Prokopieff grew up. After the war, the surviving Attuans returned to the U.S., but the government didn't allow them to return home to their now-abandoned island. Many settled further east in Atka, but others never returned to the region. That includes Teresa Deal. Raised by two white parents in Washington State, she never really learned about her birth mother's life on Attu or her captivity in Japan. But she always got questions about her background.
They think I'm Polynesian, they think I'm Mexican, they think I'm all sorts of stuff, and then they tell them, no, I'm from the Aleutian Islands, and then you get the blank stare, and so they get a lesson in geography when they meet me.
Now, this is her first time in the Aleutians, her first time being close to the history of her mom's family.
I wish I even knew more about the culture so that I can tell my sons about the culture. My sons know that they're Aleut, but they know less than I do.
For the descendants, the day spent on the boat felt like a big family reunion. After 2 days of travel, it was time for the part of the trip everyone was anticipating.
We're here. We made it. We're getting ready to land on Attu. Very exciting. If I could dance, I would totally dance right now.
The old Attu site lies in a protected cove, encircled by lush green mountains. The grasses grow long and wild, interspersed with purple and yellow flowers. But there's no sign of the former village. As they take in the land, the descendants find the foundation of their old church, plant a cross they've brought, and hold a ceremony to honor their ancestors and their lost community. From there, they gather grass for traditional baskets and other mementos to remember this once-in-a-lifetime trip.
And I'm bringing dirt back to my sisters. So they're going to be able to touch that too. And
Christine Keel grew up in Washington State without any exposure to the culture. Her mom, Agnes Prosoff, was from Attu, but she died when Keel was 9. She carries a big plastic bag that she's filling with sand, rocks, and other treasures of the past. As she goes, she's joined by Teresa Deal, the other descendant who grew up outside Alaska. While walking the beach, they start to unpack some of the complicated emotions this trip has brought up.
Christine, what do you think about being back here?
It made me cry because, this was where my mother was born, and She's denied her life here, which would have been so much better than, you know, a different quality of what she would have gotten, you know, being in Washington. And
I agree, because the people that were born out here and got to stay out here, they have such a different culture, and it's like they're very proud of their culture also, whereas we just, you know, growing up as regular Americans.
It makes me angry, because...
Right, because our lives were also stolen, not just their lives.
Stolen, and I don't believe in racism or passing judgment, but it's been really hard to not be angry at the Japanese for taking her. They were just here minding their own business, living their lives.
Now, did your mom teach you that anger at the Japanese, or just you?
No, I think it's just me. If she did teach it to me, I was too young to remember. Yeah. It's really hurtful.
Yeah.
And I know that they were just doing their job, but...
Yeah, because my mom, she taught me... We had to feel empathy for the Japanese internment because it was just wrong. You know, the Japanese internment, that was even more cruel, I think, than our parents as prisoners of war.
Both of them agree that hate isn't productive. Diehl says she's made a conscious choice not to hate the Japanese. Instead, she feels sad for them. For Kiel, she realizes that her mixed emotions stem from loss.
There's a million thoughts going through my mind because I've wanted to step foot on this island since my mother had died, and I really feel that she died as a result of the war. She became an alcoholic, she was an anorexic, and that ultimately took her life.
But spending time with other Atuans, Kiel says, is exhilarating. Because of this trip, she's motivated to make her own regalia and bring grass back for her sister who weaves. Diehl says it'll be hard to immerse herself in the culture living outside Alaska, but she's hoping to return for a regional culture camp and learn more about her heritage. For The World, Zoe Sobel, Attu Island, Alaska.
On the subject of the displacement of indigenous people, an important milestone tomorrow, the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Navajo Nation Treaty of 1868. The treaty between the Navajo Nation and the U.S. government allowed the Navajo to return home after being forced from their homes in brutal marches known as the Long Walk. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from young Navajo people who are still wrestling today with the history of what happened to their ancestors.
We don't talk about it. It's just something you don't talk about. It was a painful time, the Long Walk, and what happened to our people and why we are the way we are now.
And even those who do know the history and do talk about it, they have trouble finding it reflected in the world around them, even in some museums in the American West.
There wasn't one mention of any relationship, contact, or history with Native Americans. It was completely devoid of the story, which was just blowing my mind.
The history of the Long Walk and of the Navajo Nation Treaty of 1868. You'll hear all about it tomorrow here on the show. Hope you can join us then. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. may be the global leader in developing artificial intelligence technology, but China also wants in, and now French President Emmanuel Macron has a plan too.
It's basically to take a very serious look at how artificial intelligence is developing and try to make France a major player.
How the French want to make AI more ethical, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Harvard School of Public Health issued a stunning report this week. Researchers found that as many as 5,000 Americans died in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico last year. That was mainly due to the breakdown of basic health services on the island. That number, 5,000, is way higher than the official toll of 64. It's also stunning to learn that the U.S. does not employ standardized tools and metrics for assessing disasters and evaluating responses.
It's very frustrating for me as a disaster researcher.
Malka Older spent 10 years as an aid worker in different parts of the world and is now doing a PhD on disaster responses. What's most maddening for her is the fact that those tools are available.
There's a wide range of tools that exist in the international arena to try and track both the impacts of disasters, but also the competency, the effectiveness of our responses to disasters.
And what kind of tools? When you say tools, what are you talking about?
So the most basic thing that we use in terms of measuring our responses are the SPHERE guidelines, which is a set of guidelines that were developed by the International Community of Humanitarian Response to look at how we can make sure that we're doing something that's helpful to people. So it includes things like the amount of water per day per person that should be provided in an emergency situation, or the amount of square feet per person in an emergency shelter, the distance that a latrine should be from a water source. And so not all of these are applicable in every situation. And you're not always going to hit your targets in every situation either. Mm. But it gives us something to aim for, and it gives us something to measure so that we know that how we're doing in relationship to some kind of metric. Otherwise, every time you work a disaster, you're just kind of saying, well, this is probably the best we could do this time. And that's just not very helpful in terms of accountability and in terms of improving our performance for the next disaster, because there's always going to be another disaster.
And were those guidelines used, you know, by the U.S. and Puerto Rico?
Those guidelines are not used by the U.S. They're not used by any government that I'm aware of, although the U.S., as well as other governments, do ask international agencies to conform to and use those guidelines in their evaluations when they're using U.S. money to respond overseas. What we say in disaster studies, in the literature of disaster studies, the hurricane is not the disaster. The earthquake is not the disaster. Those are hazards. If an earthquake happens in an area where nobody lives or where people live only in tents, there's not going to be a disaster there. It is the interaction of that hazard with our human systems, breaking them down, that causes a disaster, that causes casualties, that causes loss of assets. You know, it's very easy to say, well, every disaster is different. Every disaster is. They're all unique. They all have different characteristics. And yet we're able to compare our responses to hurricanes and to earthquakes and to tsunamis, because what we're looking at is the needs. What we're looking at is where those hazards have interacted with human vulnerabilities and created needs for shelter, for medicine, for food, and also caused casualties and damages.
So if governments are not using guidelines, are you suggesting that each time there's a disaster, they reinvent the wheel?
Somewhat. It's very frustrating for me as a disaster researcher who's working on a dissertation, which, as you may know, takes quite a few years, to have gone out and done my research and started drawing conclusions for it. And as I'm writing this up, to see this happen again and again with Hurricane Sandy, with Harvey, with Irma, with Maria, where you see many of the same problems coming up over and over again. And, you know, you see them not being fully measured and analyzed and understood in the media, and therefore by, you know, the people whose votes are supposed to maintain accountability on our government and our leadership to respond, prepare and respond appropriately to disasters.
Author and aid worker Malka Older, her PhD, is focused on disaster response. Malka, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
With the exception of Israel, there's probably no place where anti-Semitism is a more sensitive subject than Germany, given its Nazi past. But in recent years, there's been increasing concern that anti-Semitism may be on the rise again in Germany. There have been some high-profile attacks in recent months. Many Germans blame the recent arrival of Muslim asylum seekers for the hatred, but many other people say that's only part of the story. Esme Nicholson reports from Berlin.
Germany's Jewish population is small, around 200,000. Yet in schoolyards here, the word Jew is heard regularly, and not in a good way.
Jew is an insult here. If you want to insult somebody, whether they're Jewish or not, it doesn't matter, but it's the thing you throw at them. Oh, he's a real Jew, or you're a Jew. That's a sort of go-to insult.
Gemma Michalski, who's British, German and Jewish, knows what she's talking about. Her 14-year-old son is the grandson of a Holocaust survivor. Michalski said he was so badly bullied by fellow students in Berlin that he had to move to another school, and the bullies were Muslim kids. Her son's ordeal made headlines here, and the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD, was quick to declare Facebook solidarity with the family and with the rest of Germany's Jewish community, even though you often hear anti-Semitic rhetoric from prominent AfD members. Georg Pizerski leads the Berlin branch of the AfD.
In Germany, it's very easy to say right-wing is anti-Semitism. It's anti-Semitism from our new Muslim population.
The police say over 90% of anti-Jewish hate crimes in Germany last year were committed by right-wing extremists. But there are no nationwide data on anti-Semitic incidents that aren't considered crimes, like schoolyard insults.
To say that anti-Semitism in Germany is a Muslim problem is just factually incorrect. The sad truth is it happens in schools with Muslim kids, and it happens in schools where there isn't a single Muslim kid in a white German school.
Gemma Michalski says she was shocked by the school's response to the abuse her son suffered from Muslim peers.
The fact that the school just said, well, look, they've got these views from home, so what you're going to do is, and threw up their hands, that is deeply Islamophobic, if you like, kind of really deeply racist.
Dervis Izaci agrees. Izaci is 34, the son of Turkish immigrants in Berlin, but he acknowledges that anti-Jewish sentiment is widespread among Muslim kids here, struggling to make sense of the Middle East conflict. And he heads an initiative that tries to tackle these issues. He says that many of the teens he works with often feel outcasts themselves, not least because of the rise of right-wing populism.
When AfD says that they are the guarantors of Jewish life in Germany because the enemy is the bad Muslim, it's not about Jews and also not about their own anti-Semitism, but it's just because of their hate towards Muslims.
Izaci says it doesn't help that most of the kids he deals with have never even met someone who's Jewish, someone like Esther Knochenhauer. She's 33 and grew up in Russia and Germany, although she sounds American. And she's a member of a group called Rent-A-Jew.
Rent-A-Jew is an initiative where people can write to us and say we really need to see a Jew. It sounds horrible. Mostly it's schools. And that's great because the young kids, they don't have too many stereotypes, and you can actually still catch them from becoming anti-Semitic. So if they meet us and we're nice, they're all okay then.
Knochenhauer is leading a workshop with seventh graders at a school in an affluent Berlin suburb. It's not a diverse place.
Finden Sie es doof dass Sie als Juden geboren sind?
One boy asks Knochenhauer whether she wishes she hadn't been born Jewish. Another asks whether it's okay to be gay if you're Jewish.
You get different questions from different schools. One was in Neukölln, so there was a lot of people from Arabic countries, and they asked all the Palestine questions. And then there was a school that was out in Brandenburg, and they actually asked us if we're fine with farmers who raise pigs. I was just like, I don't really care. I'm fine. You know, I do enjoy a bit of bacon. So yay, you know.
Knochenhauer says she does feel anti-Semitism is on the rise, but that it's hardly new.
Anti-Semitism hasn't come here in the past 2 years. It's been around. I just don't think it's right to say that if all these migrants would leave, then we would have solved the problem with anti-Semitism, because that's just not going to work.
Some, though, are more worried than others. Germany's Central Council of Jews has warned Jews not to wear kippahs and other religious symbols in public for fear of attacks.
Können wir das unter keinen Umständen hinnehmen?
In response, last month, thousands of Germans of all faiths took to the streets in major cities across the country. They wore kippahs to show their support. But since then, an 11-year-old girl and a 37-year-old woman were attacked in two separate incidents for wearing headscarves. For The World, Esme Nicholson, Berlin.
Now to a couple of other news stories that we're following for you today. With a little help from our friends at the BBC, this first item is on the murder of yet another journalist in Mexico, the 6-1 killed this year. His name was Hector Gonzalez. He worked as a print and broadcast journalist in the northern state of Tamaulipas. He'd been reported missing for a couple of days before his body was found. My colleague Shaima Khalil asked the BBC's Ana Gabriela Rojas in Mexico City for the latest.
We know it was a very violent crime. Hector was beaten to death and his body was found in a street in Ciudad Victoria, the capital of Tamaulipas. The police has said that all the lines of investigation are still open and his work is one of them. We know that he worked for a national newspaper called Excelsior, and normally he covered general information and politics. Normally here, the investigation of murders of journalists take weeks, even months. You know, I've been talking to free speech advocacy groups like Committee to Protect Journalists, and they point out that the impunity of those crimes is very high. It's over 99%. That means to kill a journalist here in Mexico is most likely to go without any consequences.
So there isn't really any optimism to find out who killed him or why he was targeted that way? Because as you say, other murders have gone unpunished.
Exactly. I mean, we'll have to wait weeks or even months. I mean, we can remember the case of Javier Valdez, which was a very iconic journalist here in Mexico because he was internationally awarded. He was covered narco in the north of the country. He was killed in May last year. And only last month, one of his murders was arrested.
You speak about narco or the narcotics trade. And of course, this has been the cause behind so much violence in Mexico. Last year, there was a record of homicides. Tell me a little bit more about the state where Hector worked, Tamaulipas. Is it especially violent? Is there that dynamic of the narcotics trade dominating that area?
Yes, it's in the north of the country, so it's a very important point of the narco to pass drugs into the United States. And it's actually considered a silent zone. That means most of the journalists have been silenced or fled the area because of the threats of the narco.
That was reporter Ana Gabriela Rojas in Mexico City speaking with my colleague Shaima Khalil. And another story our partners in London have been working on, it's about the Sleeping Lion. Sounds like a pub, but it's not. It's actually a pearl that's just sold at auction in the Netherlands for close to $375,000. Here's Anna Holligan with the pretty amazing backstory.
A rare, glistening gem created entirely by Mother Nature. The pearl weighs 120 grams, a little more than your average bar of soap, and is almost 7 centimetres long. But those statistics only tell a fraction of this story. Dr. Hanko Zwan is from the Netherlands Gemological Laboratory.
Why is it so special? First of all, it's extremely large to begin with. Second, it's a natural pearl, so it's not cultured. So most pearls we see today are all cultured. The third thing is that it's not from salt water, but from fresh water, actually.
The extraordinary jewel is thought to have been formed in Chinese waters in the first half of the 18th century, during the Qing Dynasty. Sometime around 1765, the pearl was moved to Jakarta, at the time Batavia, by a Dutch merchant from the Dutch East India Company. And here's where the detail gets murky. It was then shipped across to Europe, probably violating the Chinese Emperor Qinglong's ban on the export of large pearls. When the Dutch merchant passed away, the pearl was auctioned off in Amsterdam in 1778 and acquired by Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia. Catherine displayed the pearl at the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg until 1796. In the tumultuous years that followed her death, the pearl vanished and turned up in Poland. In 1865, it came into the possession of a Dutch goldsmith and was passed down as a family heirloom for 4 generations. In 1779, it was purchased by the Amsterdam Pearl Society. And Herman A. Domesay, who's been explaining why he's selling it today.
You can say, because I need a new car or something like that, but that's not the reason.
A private collector with a very important natural history piece, it had to be displayed in an institution. I think the public had to see it.
The Sleeping Lion's epic journey continues.
The BBC's Anna Holligan reporting. When it comes to developing artificial intelligence technologies, experts seem to agree that the U.S. private sector is leading the way. Elsewhere in the world, though, it's the public sector that's beginning to strategize about how to develop and harness the technology. Case in point, France recently laid out its national plan for artificial intelligence. Nicholas Thompson is editor-in-chief at Wired magazine, and he recently spoke with French President Emmanuel Macron about his country's AI plan. So I'm almost surprised, Nicholas, to hear that the president of a Western country is being so forward-thinking about this. What is France's plan on AI?
That was the thing that surprised me the most, just to have a national leader who could talk so fluently and so passionately about such a complex subject for a long period of time. Their plan has a number of different elements. It is to support investment in artificial intelligence. It is to use national incentives to try to get companies to move to France, to invest more heavily in France, to develop AI in France. It's basically to take a very serious look at how artificial intelligence is developing and try to make France a major player.
And was there like one thing that struck you about Macron's approach when it comes to AI?
The thing that stuck out the most to me was that he has a sense that artificial intelligence is going to change a lot of really important things in the world, and that there will be value systems embedded in whatever is built, and that he cares a lot about French values being part of those AI values.
So here's what Macron told you about that.
What I see today is that when you look at artificial intelligence, the two leaders are US and China. Mm-hmm. US, this is totally driven by private sector. All the choices they will make are private choices. On the other side, Chinese players basically collect a lot of data and a lot of innovation driven by the government, mm-hmm. whose principles and values are not ours. And Europe has not exactly the same collective preferences as the US or China.
So, Nicholas, a lot to unpack there. But first of all, what do you make of what he just said, kind of that dichotomy between public and private sectors driving AI?
He's right. I mean, AI is being driven almost entirely by the US and China. And in the US, it is almost entirely by the private sector. And in China, it's being driven by Chinese companies, by Alibaba, by Baidu. But those companies are very close to the state. And the state has made it a national priority to have AI supremacy by 2030. And then his question about the values, again, I think it's a very astute point. The sort of the central question he's asking, which is how do you make sure that technology develops with the inclusion of European values, French values, Western values of liberal democracy and privacy?
Well, let's dive directly into that because he spoke about that, Macron did. Here's what he had to say about the importance of building algorithms that guide these AI machines in an ethical, unbiased way.
I have to guarantee the loyalty of this algorithm. I have to guarantee there is no bias in terms of sex, age, and specific selection for my people, except if this is the one I decided on behalf of them or in front of them. And that's a huge issue. If you don't deal with that at the very beginning, if you don't consider that's an issue as important as developing economic innovation, you will miss something, and at a point of time, it will block everything because your people will finally reject this innovation.
So, Nicholas Thompson, I don't know if he sent you a one-pager on what his plan is, but do these ethical and philosophical considerations come through in his plan, and how does he plan to make it a reality?
I don't know if you can make it a reality. You know, one of the famous examples of the problem that he's talking about comes from artificial intelligence systems that are designed to more efficiently sentence criminals in the United States. And the way to train an AI system to sentence criminals is you give it all your historical sentencing data. The problem, though, is that our historical sentencing data in the United States is racist. And so what Macron is saying is, well, we don't want values like that embedded in our AI system. And on the sentencing data, you can figure out how to control for that and how to knock it out. But the problem is on the super complex data sets that we're going to be looking at in the future, I'm not sure if you can do that. And also one of the points of AI is that it thinks in ways that we don't comprehend. So I didn't get a one-pager on what his plan is or how he'll solve this massive existential problem for humanity that no one really has a complete answer for right now. But I do think it's great that he's thinking about it, talking about it, and trying to, at this very early stage of this transformative technology, help us steer it in the right direction.
Are you also scratching your head as to whether Macron is returning to a kind of age of French imperialism and wanting to be the first to colonize AI?
That doesn't really bother me or worry me, in part because they're so far behind. It's like French imperialism, but the only thing at stake is an island, right? I mean, they're so far behind the United States and China that they're not going to be able to take over the world. You know, it is an interesting thought experiment, though. What if it was, you know, Le Pen, whose values I'm less inclined to agree with, saying I want to push my values into AI? I would have had a very different reaction if all the same words were spoken.
Right, former candidate for the presidency, Marine Le Pen. Yeah.
I mean, it's very interesting to think, what if, you know, so I left the interview cheered, thinking, well, isn't it great, you know, that Emmanuel Macron, who has all this beautiful art on his walls while we're talking, is, you know, pushing his value system into AI. If it had been a French leader with very different values, I would have been less enthusiastic, and that's something that one should think about.
Nicholas Thompson, he's editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. Thanks very much for being with us and telling us about your conversation with Macron.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. It was a pleasure to be here.
As France explores the future, we're going to dig back in the vaults today for some closing music. In 1997, Blue Note Records decided to provide some young, up-and-coming musicians a showcase by letting them reprise classic rock albums with a jazzy treatment. One of the releases was by a Pakistani-American guitarist named Fareed Hawk. He did a sweet track-by-track cover of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Deja Vu. Fareed Hawk has gone on to big things. We did a story on Fareed when the album came out. The World's Clark Boyd did that story. Clark has also gone on to big things, went on to produce this show for the past few years. Today, though, Clark leaves our newsroom for a new chapter. He's been a great colleague and a masterful show producer. You've been hearing his work with every interview and every story on our air every day, pretty much. We'll miss him for that leadership and for his talents at baking bread as well. His loaves have often filled this office with happiness on days when we seem to need it the most. So, Clark, this song is for you. Fareed Hawk's cover of Almost Cut My Hair. Sorry, guy, I had to get one final zinger in. Happy trails, my friend. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with the rest of y'all tomorrow.
Public Radio International.